an attempt by the cathedral to hold on to everyone to keep them from leaving the planet as Miss Rice had ordered. However, the note had the authentic ring of Glimmung's style. If the notes were forgeries, they were good ones. Taking the last sheet of paper, Joe wrote an answer on the back of it in block letters. "If you are in good health, why are you staying down below? Signed, worried employee." He stuffed the note in one of the bottles, put in a weight from his belt, screwed tight the lid, and dropped the bottle over the side of the boat. It sank immediately, and almost immediately came bobbing back up. He fished it in and opened it. "I am currently dispatching the Black Cathedral. Will return to the dry land when that has been done. Signed, confident employer. P.S. Get the others. They will be needed. G." Obediently, but without conviction, Joe putt-putted back to the lit-up staging area. He located a vidphone, there were several, and when connected, asked the autonomic phone system to connect him with the tower at the planet's sole spaceport. "When did the last major ship take off?" he asked the tower. "Yesterday." "Then you have an inter-system ship on your pad right now?" "Yes, we do." Good news, and yet, in a sense, ominous news, too. Joe said, "Glimmung wants it halted and the passengers dispersed so that they can come here." "You have authority to speak for Mr. Glimmung?" "Yes," Joe said. "Prove it." "He told me orally." "Prove it." "If you let the ship go," Joe said, "then Held Scala will never be raised, and Glimmung will destroy you." "Let's see you verify that." "Let me talk to Miss Rice," Joe said. "Who is Miss Rice?" "Aboard the ship, Glimmung's private secretary." "I can't take orders from her either. I'm autonomic." "Did a huge flapping thing completely black come your way?"
"No."
"Well," Joe said, "it's heading there. It should show up any time. Everyone on board the ship will die because you won't tell them to disperse." "Neurotic panic alarms cannot dissuade me," the tower said, but it sounded uneasy now. There was a pause. Joe sensed it straining to see and hear at the farthest reach of its sensory apparatus. The tower said haltingly. "I think I see it." "Disperse the ship's passengers," Joe said, "before it's too late." "But they'll be sitting hens," the tower said. "Ducks," Joe corrected. "My point is clear, though the metaphor be wrong," the tower said. But now it sounded uncertain of itself. "Perhaps I should put you through to someone aboard the ship." "Hurry," Joe said. The phone screen showed a variety of unnatural colors, and then upon it there appeared the rugged, gray, massive head of Harper Baldwin. "Yes, Mr. Fernwright?" He, like the tower, showed acute nervousness. "We're just leaving. I understand a false Glimmung is headed this way. Unless we take off immediately..." "The orders are changed," Joe said. "Glimmung is alive and well and wants you all here at the Aquatic Staging Center, as soon as possible." A cool, practical, competent face appeared on the vidscreen. A near-female face. "This is Hilda Rice. In a situation like this, our only viable alternative is to evacuate Plowman's planet. I thought you understood that. I told Miss Yoyez..." "But Glimmung wants you here," Joe said. "The red tape, the damn red tape." He held the note from Glimmung before the vidscreen. "You recognize his writing? As his personal private secretary, you should." She peered, forehead wrinkled. "It will no longer be necessary for anyone to leave the planet," she read aloud. "Notify them that I am all right, and tell them..." Joe held the next note before the screen. "Get the others," Miss Rice read. "I see. Well, that is certainly quite distinct." She eyed Joe. "All right, Mr. Fernwright. We will hire Word's drivers and vehicles and come to the staging center post-haste. You can expect us in 10 or 15 minutes. For a number of reasons, I hope that the false Glimmung let loose will not destroy us on the way. Bye." She rang off then. The screen became dark, the receiver silent. 10 minutes, Joe thought. And with the black Glimmung over their heads, they'll be lucky if they can get any Wurges to drive them. Even the autonomic tower, a synthetic construct, had been worried. The hope of their arriving at the Aquatic Staging Center seemed dim. Half an hour passed. There was no sign of a hovercraft, no manifestation of the group. "It got them," Joe Fernwright said to himself. "They're finished. And meanwhile, Glimmung battles the Black Cathedral at the bottom of Mare Nostrum. Everything is being decided right now." "Why don't they come?" he asked himself violently. "Did it get them? Are they corpses floating in the water or drying to bleach teeth and bones on the land?" And Glimmung, what about him? Even if they get here, everything still depends on Glimmung's victory over the Black Cathedral. If he dies, then they've come here for nothing. We will all leave here, leave the planet. Back to overcrowded Earth for me, with phony money, the vet's dole, the empty cubicle where nothing happens. And the game, the goddamn game, for the remainder of my life. I'm not going to leave here, he said to himself, even if Glimmung dies. But what would this world be like without Glimmung? Ruled by the Book of the Kalends, a mechanistic world, each day cranked out by the Book, a world without freedom. The Book will tell us each day what we are going to do, and we will do it. And eventually the Book will tell us we are going to die, and we will die, he thought. The Book was wrong. It said what I found down below the surface of the ocean would cause me to kill Glimmung. And it didn't. But Glimmung could still die. The prophecy could still come true. Two battles remained. The battle to destroy the Black Cathedral, and the battle, the terrible task, of lifting Heldskalla to the surface. Glimmung could die during either. He could be dying right now, and all our hopes with him. He turned on the radio to see if there was any news. Impotent, the radio said. Unable to achieve an orgasm. Hardivax will turn disappointment into joy. Another voice, then, that of a miserable male. Gosh, Sally, I don't know what's been the matter with me. I know you've noticed that I'm completely flaccid of late. Gosh, everyone's noticed. A female voice, then. Henry, what you need is a simple pill called Hardivax, and in days you'll be a real man. Hardivax? Henry echoed. Gosh, maybe I should try it. Then the announcer's voice again. At your nearby drugstore, or write direct to... Joe shut it off at that point. Now I know what Willis meant, he said to himself. A large hover car landed at the miniature field of the staging center. He heard it arrive. He felt the building quiver and vibrate. So they made it, he said to himself, and hurried toward the field to meet them. His legs felt like heated thermoplastic. He could barely support himself. Harper Baldwin, tall and stern, emerged first. There you are, Fernwright. Harper Baldwin shook hands cordially with Joe. He seemed relaxed now. It was quite a battle. What happened? Joe said as the sharp-faced middle-aged woman stepped out. Christ's sakes, he thought. Don't just stand there, tell me. How did you get away from it? He asked as the reddish, heavy-set man emerged, then the matronly woman, and after her the timid little fellow. Molly Yoyez, appearing, said, Calm down, Joe, you get so agitated. Now the non-humanoid life forms made their way from the hovercraft onto the small field. The multi-legged gastropod, the immense dragonfly, the furry ice cube, the red jelly supported by its metal frame, the univalvular cephalopod, the kindly-looking bivalve nerve-cold dac, the quasi-arachnid, its chitinous shell gleaming, its many legs drumming, and then the portly rope-tailed Wourge driver himself. The various forms scuttled, wiggled, walked, and haltingly slithered under the protection of the three hermetically sealed domes of the staging center, getting themselves out of the nocturnal cold. Molly alone remained with Joe, except for the Wourge driver, who loitered nearby, smoking some peculiar form of native grass. It looked pleased with itself. "Was it that bad?" Joe asked Molly. Still pale and tense, but like Harper Baldwin beginning to unwind, Molly said, "It was awful, Joe." And no one's going to talk about it, Joe said. I'll talk, Molly said. Just give me a moment. Holding out her hand to the Wourge, she said, Just give me a moment. She trembled, then got out a cigarette, smoked rapidly, passed the cigarette to Joe. When Ralph and I were here, we got to using this. I find it helpful. He shook his head no, and Molly nodded. Let's see. She ruminated. After your call, we got out of the ship. As we were leaving the ship, the Black Glimmung approached and began to circle the ship. We hailed this Wourge and... I took off, the Wourge said proudly. Yes, it took off, Molly continued. It was told the situation fully and completely in case it didn't want to take us, and it flew almost touching the ground. It flew, I would say, on an average of 10 feet above the nearby buildings and in the open country. And most important of all, it took a route it was familiar with. To the Wourge, she said... I forget why you developed that strange anabasis. Explain again. The Wourge removed the cigarette from its gray lips and said, Income tax violators. Yes, Molly said to Joe, nodding. Plowman's planet has a huge income tax, roughly 70% of earned gross income as an average. It varies, of course, depending on the bracket. You see, the Wourges usually drive that route the other way, That is, starting in a distant residential spot and zigzagging, etc., to the spaceport, avoiding the native police and tax agents and getting the passenger aboard a ship before he's caught. Once in the ship, he's safe, because the ship is recognized as extra-national territory, like an embassy.
I can always get them there, the word said sleekly. Onto a ship before they're caught. No police cruiser, even with radar, can spot me as I zero in on the spaceport. In 10 years, I've been stopped only once, and that time I was clean.
It grinned as it puffed on its cigarette. Joe said, "You mean the black limung took off after you?"
"No," Molly said. "It crashed into the ship a few minutes after we vacated it. The ship was totally destroyed, according to what we heard over the air, and the black limung was injured."
"Then why did you need an elaborate escape route?" Joe asked, bewildered.
"It seemed like a good idea at the time," Molly said. "I understand from Hilda Rice that Glimmung is currently attacking the Black Cathedral. Have you heard any further word since the note Miss Rice saw over the vidphone?"
"No," Joe said. "I haven't looked. I was waiting for all of you to show up."
"One more minute," Molly said, "aboard that ship sitting there waiting for takeoff, and we would have been killed."
"It was too close, Joe. I wouldn't want to live through it again. I think it thought the ship was alive because the ship was so large. And we were too small. Apparently, it never saw the hover car."
"Funny things happen on this planet," the word said.
Now it was picking its teeth with its elongated thumbnail. It all at once held out its hand.
"What do you want?" Joe said. "To shake hands?"
"No," the word said. "I want 0.85 of a crumble. They said you'd pay the bill for me bringing them here over my extra good escape-type route."
"Bill Glimmung," Joe said.
"You don't have 0.85 of a crumble?" the Word asked.
"No," Joe said.
"Do you?" the Word said to Molly.
"None of us has been paid," Molly said. "We'll pay you when Glimmung pays us."
"I would call in the police," the Word said, but fundamentally it appeared to be reconciled.
Basically, Joe decided, it's a humble creature. It will let us pay later. Molly took his arm and led him indoors. The words remained behind, glowering fruitlessly, but it did not try to halt them.
"I think," Molly said, "that we've gained a great victory. I mean by our escape from the Black Limung and its injury. I understand that it's still there at the spaceport, and the authorities are trying to decide what to do with it. They'll wait until Glimmung tells them what they should do. That's the way they've worked for decades. In fact, since Glimmung came here. At least that's what Ralph used to say. He was very interested in the way Glimmung ran this planet. He used to say..."
"What if Glimmung does die?" Joe said.
"Then the words won't get paid," Molly said.
"I'm not thinking about that," Joe said.
"I mean this. If Glimmung dies, will the Black Glimmung be patched up and allowed to rule this planet, in his place, as the next best substitute?"
"Lord knows," Molly said. She joined the group, the variegated life forms from a variety of planets. Arms folded, she stood listening to what Harper Baldwin was saying to the kindly bivalve.
"Faust always dies," Harper Baldwin said.
Nurbcold Dak answered,
"Only in Marlowe's play and in the legends which Marlowe drew on."
"Everyone knows that Faust dies," Harper Baldwin said.
He surveyed the group of life forms gathered in a circle around him and the bivalve.
"Isn't that true?" he asked them all.
Joe said, "It's not preordained."
"Yes, it is," Harper Baldwin said emphatically. "In the Book of the Kalends, specifically. Look again. We've lost sight of it. We should have left when we could, when our ship was getting ready to fire off its launch rockets."
"Then we would have died,"
the quasi-arachnid said, its many arms waving in excitement.
"The Black Glimmung would have killed every one of us the moment it hit our ship."
"That's true," Molly put in.
"Actually, that's so," Nurbcold Dak said in his kindly way. "We are here only because Mr. Fernwright was able to reach Miss Hilda Wright and tell us that Glimmung wanted us to evacuate the ship, which we did, and not a moment—"
"Balls," Harper Baldwin said angrily.
Joe picked up his torch and walked from the staging area to the wharf. He shone the helium-powered bright light out onto the surface of dark water, seeking for something, anything, any sign of Glimmung's condition. He examined his watch. Nearly an hour had passed since Glimmung had met the Black Glimmung and had dropped to the floor of Mare Nostrum to do fatal battle with his doppelganger, and after that to struggle with the Black Cathedral itself. Is he alive? Joe wondered. Would his corpse float to the surface, or like mine, would it remain down below in the realm of decay, rotting into offal, hiding in a box or other construct, not alive and yet not totally inert, a kind of semi-sentient state that might continue for centuries? And the Black Cathedral would be free to rise to the surface and onto dry land. Once Glimmung is dead, then nothing can halt it. Maybe there was a further note. He searched the water for a bottle. He whisked the light here and there, sweeping out an enormous area. No bottle, nothing. Molly came up beside him.
Anything?
No, he said curtly.
Do you know what I think?
Molly said.
I think, as I've always thought, that he's fated to fail. The book is right, and Harper Baldwin is right. Faust always fails, and Glimmung is an incarnation of Faust. The striving, the restless intensity, it's all there. The legend is fulfilled, in fact, is being fulfilled right now as we stand here.
Maybe so, Joe said, still lashing the water with shafts of white light. Molly took his arm and nuzzled close to him.
It's safe now. We could leave. The Black One isn't after us anymore.
I'm staying here. Joe moved away from her, still sweeping the water with his torch. No thoughts crossed his mind. Mentally, he was blank, merely listening passively, waiting, waiting for a clue, a sign, any sign of what was going on below. All at once, the water stirred. He swung the torch, lit up that general area. He strained to see. Something enormous was attempting to come to the surface. What was it? Held Scala, Glimmung, or the Black Cathedral? He waited, trembling. The vast object made the water boil and hiss. Clouds of steam traveled upward, and the night was alive with a full roaring, a cauldron of haste and activity and titanic effort. Molly said quietly,
"It's Glimmung, and he's badly hurt."
Chapter 15. The hoop of fire had been extinguished. Only one hoop turned, the hoop of water, and it grated piercingly. As if, Joe thought, a machine is dying, not a living creature. The others of the group made their way to the wharf.
"He's failed,"
the red jelly supported by the metal frame said.
"You can see, he's beginning to die."
"Yes," Joe said aloud, and was surprised to hear his own voice. It rang harshly in the midst of the moans rising from the injured Glimmung. Several others in the group echoed his word. It was as if he had pronounced a ban, as if it was his decision to make whether Glimmung would live or not live. "But we can't really be sure until we get out there," he said. He set down his torch and descended the wooden ladder to the parked boat. "I'm going to go and find out," he said. He reached for his torch and then, squatting and shivering in the chill night wind, started the engine of the boat.
"Don't go," Molly said.
Joe grated, "I'll see you in a little while." He guided the boat from its dock, out into the furiously lapping waves created by the thrashing bulk of Glimmung's body. An enormity of injury, he thought, as the boat rose and fell, putt-putting its way anxiously forward. Injury on a scale which we really can't understand. "Damn it," he thought with bitterness. "Why does it have to end this way? Why couldn't it have been otherwise?" He felt numb, as if death were assailing him too, as if he and Glimmung... The huge shape wallowed in the water, and as it lay, blood poured from it. Like Christ on the cross, it bled eternally, as if its blood supply was infinite. As if, Joe thought, this moment is going to last forever. Me in the boat, trying to get close, and him floundering and bleeding and dying. God, he thought, this is awful, truly awful. And yet he guided the boat on, closer and closer. From the depths of himself, Glimmung said,
"I need you. All of you."
"What can we do?"
He continued on, closer and closer. Now the periphery of the body strained and twisted only a yard from the prow of the boat. Water and blood swamped its way into the boat. Joe felt it sink below him. He gripped the sides, tried to shift his weight, but blood and water continued to pour in. "I will be drowned," he thought, in another few seconds. Reluctantly, he reversed direction. He backed away from Glimmung. The boat ceased taking liquid. And yet he felt no better. His fear and agony remained the same, his empathetic identification with his dying employer. Glimmung sputtered,
I...
He slobbered now, rolling on his side, unable to control the thrashing of his maimed body.
"Whatever it is," Joe said, "we'll do it."
"That's inordinately receptive of you," Glimmung managed to whisper,
and then he revolved entirely. He sank below the surface, so that speech for him became impossible. The end, Joe thought, has come. Wretchedly, he turned the boat about and, misery weighing him down, steered for the wharf once more. It was over. As he tied up the boat, Molly and Harper Baldwin and several non-humanoids reached to help him. "Thanks," he said, and clumsily ascended the wooden ladder. "He's dead," Joe said. "Or almost dead. Virtually dead." He let Miss Rice and Molly sweep a blanket over him, a warm cloak which settled into place over his foam and blood-drenched body. "My God," he realized, "I'm soaking wet." He had no memory of it. At the time, he had been concerned with what he saw only, with Glimmung. Now he turned his attention on himself and found that he was wet, freezing, and filled with despair.
"Here's a local cigarette," Molly said. She placed it between his trembling lips. "Get inside. Don't watch. There's nothing you can do. You tried."
Joe said shakily, "He asked for our help."
"I know," Molly said. "We heard him."
The others of the group nodded silently, their faces bleached with unyielding pain.
"But I don't know what it is," Joe said.
"The help we can do. I don't see anything we can do, but he was trying to say. Maybe if he could have said it, we could have done it. The last thing he said, did, was to thank me."
He let Molly lead him under the hermetically sealed dome and into the radiant heat of the staging center.
"We'll leave this planet tonight," Molly said presently, as the two of them stood together.
"Okay," he said. He nodded.
"Come to my planet with me," Molly said. "Don't go back to Earth. You'd be so unhappy there."
"Yeah," he agreed. It was true. Beyond any doubt, any possible doubt, whatever. As W.S. Gilbert would have put it, "Where's Willis?" he asked, looking around. "I want to trade quotes with him."
"Quotations," Molly corrected.
He nodded in agreement.
"Yes," he said. "I meant to say quotations." "You're really tired."
"Hell," he said. "I don't know why I should be. All I did was paddle out there in a boat to try to talk with him."
"The responsibility," Molly said.
"What responsibility? I couldn't even hear him."
"But the promise you made regarding us all."
Joe said, "Anyhow, I failed."
"He failed. It's not your fault. You were listening. We all were listening. He never managed to say it."
"Is he still on the surface?" Joe asked. He peered past her, across the wharf at the water beyond.
"He's on the surface, slowly drifting this way."
Joe tossed down the cigarette, ground it out with his heel, and started for the wharf.
"Stay in here," Molly said, trying to stop him. "It's sealed against the cold. You're still wet. You'll die."
"Do you know how Gilbert died?" he asked her. "William Schwenk Gilbert? He had a heart attack trying to rescue a girl who was drowning." He pushed past her, through the thermal barrier and outdoors onto the wharf once more. "I won't die," he said to her as she followed after him. "Which, in a sense, is too bad." Maybe it would be more useful, he thought, to die with Glimmung. That way, at least, we could show how we felt. But who would notice? Who is left to notice? Spittles and Wurges, he thought. And robots. He continued on, pushing his way through the group until he reached the edge of the wharf. Four torches illuminated the expiring hulk which had once been Glimmung. In their light, Joe watched, as the others watched, silently. He could think of no comment, and no comment seemed to be needed. "Look at him," he said to himself. "And I brought it about. So the Book of the Kalends was right after all. By going down below, I caused his death."
"You did it," Hopper Baldwin said to him.
"Yep," Joe said stoically.
"Any reason?"
the multi-legged gastropod lisped.
"No," Joe said, "unless you want to count stupidity."
"I'm ready to count it," Hopper Baldwin rasped.
"Okay," Joe said, "you do that."
He looked, he looked, he looked. Glimmung came closer, closer, closer. And then, at the edge of the wharf, almost against it, the body reared up.
"Watch out!"
Molly screamed from behind him. The group broke, scattered, hurried toward the security of the hermetically sealed dome. Too late. Glimmung's bulk descended on the wharf, the wood splintered and sank. Joe, gazing up, saw from outside into the immense body, and then, a moment later, saw from inside the body out. Glimmung had enclosed them, all. No one had escaped, not even the robot Willis, who had stood far off to one side. Caught up, trapped, included in that which was Glimmung. He heard Glimmung speak, heard not through his ears, but in his brain, and at the same time heard the babble of the others, of the remainder of the group, their voices, the unceasing din, muttered beyond Glimmung's own voice, like crosstalk.
"Help me! Where am I? Get me out of here!"
They babbled against one another like disturbed, frightened ants, and Glimmung's voice boomed, overpowering but not quenching them.
"I have asked you here today," Glimmung declared, bombarding Joe's brain, "because I need your help. Only you can give it to me."
"We're a part of him," Joe realized. "A part." He tried to see, but his eyes registered only a swirling jello-like image, a film which obliterated rather than revealed the reality around him. I'm not on the edge, he thought. I'm at the center, so I have no vision. Those at the edge can see, but... Please, listen to me, Glimmung interrupted, fragmenting his bat-like flittering thoughts. Concentrate. If you do not, you will be absorbed and finally vanish, and hence be of no use to me or to anyone else. I need you to live as separate entities combined within my one somatic presence.
Will we ever get out? Harper Baldwin yammered. Are we going to have to remain in here forever?
I want out! Miss Rice cried in panic. Let me loose!
Please, the immense dragonfly implored. I want to fly and sing. I am held down in here, pushed and compressed and made not alone. Sanction my flight, Glimmung.
Free us, Nurb Koldak begged. This is unfair.
You're destroying us.
We're being sacrificed for your ends.
How can we help if we're destroyed?
Glimmung said, You are not destroyed. You are engulfed.
That's being destroyed, Joe said.
No, Glimmung boomed. It is not. He began to lumber away from the remains of the wharf, the scattered bits of wood which he had not absorbed. Down, Glimmung thought, and the thought impressed itself in Joe's brain, as well as in the other brains around him. Down, to the bottom. The time has come. Heldskala must be raised. Now, Glimmung thought. What sank down centuries ago will be spewed up once more to the surface. Amalita and Borel, he thought. You will be free and on the shore. It will all be as it was before, worlds without end. Depth. The water became dull. Forms darted or crept by, a multitude of them, no two alike. The snowflakes of the sea, he thought. A winter of vegetable life which crawls over and hangs on to. Let go. Before him, Heldskala lay, its pale turrets, its gothic arch, its flying buttresses, its red-stained glass made from gold. He saw all of it from a dozen eyes. It was intact, except for the engineering divisions, from another time, when he had planned to raise it externally. Now, he thought, I will enter you. I will become a part of you, and then I will rise. You will go up with me, and we shall die on the shore. But you will be saved. He made out the jagged ruins of the Black Cathedral, broken into bits, he thought, destroyed where I left you, rotten and unusable debris which serves no purpose and which no longer can block me, weak as I am. Because of all of you, he thought, I can function again. Can you hear me? He spoke distinctly. Say if you can hear me.
Yes, we can.
Yes, yes. The answering voices rattled on and on. He counted them, and they were all there, all alive and functioning as subforms of himself. All right, he said, and triumph filled him as he dove directly at Heldskala. Will we survive this? Joe Fernwright asked. He felt fear. You will, Glimmung thought, but not me. Raising his perimeters, he extended himself so that his front end served as wide an area as possible. Now you are me, he thought, and I am you, Heldskala. It has happened, despite the book. He held within him the sunken cathedral. Now, he thought. He listened. He had ceased moving. Mr. Baldwin, he thought, and Miss Yoyes, Mr. Dack, Miss Flegg, Miss Rice, can you hear me? Yes. Begrudging but genuine responses, he felt their presence, their agitation, as they held out against his pull. Come together, he told them. To survive, we must go up, and to go up requires you to act. There is no other way. There never was. How can we act? The voices asked. Combine with me, Glimmung said. Add your skills, your capacities, your strengths. Add everything to my mind. Mr. Baldwin, you move matter at a distance. Help me. Help them. Miss Yoyes, you understand the art of removing objects from coral incrustation. Do that now. Unbind the coral reaches. Mr. Fernwright, you must knit the ceramic surfaces of the cathedral together. They are clay, and you are the potter. Mr. Dack, you are a hydraulic engineer. No, Dack replied, I am a graphic archaeologist. I deal in recovered art objects. I can identify them, catalog them, and estimate their cultural value. Yes, Glimmung thought, it is Mr. Luntz who is the hydraulic engineer. I forgot the similarity of names. We will make our first run now. Glimmung told them, told the parts of himself who possessed separate identities. Probably we will sink back down, but we will try again. As long as we live? Mali Yoyes asked. Yes, he thought, we will try as long as we are alive, until the last of us is dead. But that's not fair, Harper Baldwin thought. Glimmung thought, you offered me everything you had. You yearned to help me when I lay dying. Now you are doing it. Be glad. Rejoice. He grasped the uncut floor of the cathedral with his many somatic extensions. Before, he thought, when the black Glimmung and the black cathedral were down here, I could not take the risk of lifting with my own girth. Now I can. The lift failed. The cathedral remained rooted to the coral, held fast by its mass, its weight, and bonds. He gasped, spent by the faulty effort. Everywhere within himself he ached, and all the separate voices cried out in panic and despair, and pain. It doesn't wish to come, Joe Fernwright thought. Is that so? Glimmung asked. How did you know that? I found it out, Joe thought, when I came down here. I read it on the pot, remember? Yes, Glimmung thought, I remember. He felt weary terror, the overwhelming submission which involved everything which came down here, even himself. Once again, he thought, and then he thought, Faust always fails. But, he thought, I am not Faust. You are, a multitude of voices came, a desperate din of defeat and refusal. Let us go upward, Glimmung said. We are going. He felt the base of the cathedral resist. Perhaps you are right, he thought. I know I am, the voice came. It has happened before. It will happen again. It will always happen. But I can raise Heldskala, Glimmung said to himself and to them. We can, all of us. Using them, making them his arms, he lifted. He tugged the body of the cathedral to him and forced it to rise, against its own desires. Feeling it resist, he felt bitterness and dismay. I did not know this, he thought. Perhaps this knowledge will kill me. Perhaps this is what the book meant. Perhaps, he thought, I should leave it down there. Perhaps it is better the way it is. It won't lift. He tried again. No, it will not lift. I say it will not. At any time, for anyone, under any combination of circumstances. It will rise, Joe Fernwright said, when you are recovered from your injury, the damage done to you by the Black Cathedral. What? He said, listening. Other voices joined Joe's. When you are stronger, wait until then. I must make myself stronger, he realized. Time must pass, authentic time, over which I have no control. How can they know this when I do not? He listened, but heard no voices. They had quieted into silence as soon as he ceased striving. So be it, he decided. I will rise to the surface alone, and some day, not long from now, I will try again. And once again he decided, I will absorb you, all of you. Once more you will be parts of me as you are now. All right, the voices squeaked, but let us go. Prove to us you can release us. I shall, he told them, and let himself rise to the surface. Cold night air plucked at him, and he saw feeble distant stars. On a wild shoreline, with nocturnal water birds striding about, he deposited the strident voices. He disgorged all of them, those whom he had incorporated, and then he lunged out again into the water, an aquatic world which was now safe. He could stay here forever and not be endangered by any hostile force. Thank you, Joe Fernwright, he thought. But no answer came. Internally, he was again alone. So he spoke the words aloud, and as he spoke, felt lonely. For a time, he had been inhabited. But it would come again, the warm interior babble. He examined his wounds, made himself comfortable in a half-submerged position, and waited. Shivering, his feet in sandy mud, Joe Fernwright listened and heard Glimmung's voice. Thank you, Joe Fernwright. He continued to listen, but there was no more. He could see Glimmung as the big creature lay a few hundred yards from shore. He would have killed us, Joe thought, and himself too, in trying to bring up the cathedral. Thank God he listened. That was too close, Joe said to the other creatures near him, deployed here and there along the sandy beach, and especially to Maliyoyes, who huddled close to him, trying to get warm. Much too close, he said, half to himself. He shut his eyes. Anyhow, he let us go, he reflected. And now it's just a question of walking until we come to a house or a road, unless he tries to get us back. But that did not seem likely, not anyhow for some time. Are you going to stay on Plowman's planet? Molly asked him. You know what it means. He'll reabsorb all of us who stay here. Joe said, I'm staying. Why? I want to see the book proved wrong. It's already been proved wrong. I mean, finally, Joe said, once and for all. As of now, he thought it could still be right, because we don't know what will happen tomorrow or the day after. I could still kill Glimmung, he realized, in some indirect way. But he knew that would not happen. It was too late. Like many things, it could not now be recalled. The Kalends were doomed. Their power was gone. But the book was almost right, he said. Obviously, the Kalends played the percentages. Generally, in the long run, they were correct. But in given instances, such as this, they were wrong. And this was important. This had to do with Glimmung's literal physical death and the literal physical raising of Heldskala. In relation to this, final events, such as the planet falling back into the sun from which it had arisen, did not really matter. They were too remote. In the final analysis, the Kalends might be correct. Their prophecies had to do with cosmic trends, such as the laws of thermodynamics and terminal entropy. And, of course, Glimmung would eventually die. So would he himself. So would they all. But in the here and now, Heldskala waited for Glimmung to recover. And he would. And the cathedral would come up from the water, as Glimmung planned.
"We were a polyencephalic entity," Molly said.
"Pardon?" Joe said.
"A group mind, except that we were subordinate to Glimmung. But for a little while," she gestured, "all of us, from at least 10 star systems, we functioned as a single organism. In some ways, it was exciting to not be
alone," Joe said.
"Yes, it makes me realize how isolated each of us normally is, how cut off, separated from everyone else. In particular, separated from other life. That ended when Glimmung absorbed us, and we were no longer individual failures."
"It ended," Joe said, "but it's begun again, as of now."
Molly said, "If you stay here on Plowman's planet, so will I."
"Why?"
"I like the group mind, the group will. As they say on your planet, this is where the action is."
"They haven't said that on Terra," Joe said, "for close to 100 years.
"Our textbooks were very old," Molly said contritely.
Loudly to the group members as they stood here and there, Joe said, "Okay, let's get started back to the Olympia Hotel, so we can get a hot bath and some dinner."
"And then sleep," Molly said.
He put his arm around her. "Or whatever else," he said, "that humanoids normally do." Chapter 16. The last chapter. 8 26-hour days later, Glimmung asked the group to assemble under the hermetically sealed domes of the heated, illuminated staging center. The robot Willis checked the list as each arrived. When they had all come, he notified Glimmung, and collectively they waited. Of them all, Joe Fernwright had been the first to arrive. He made himself comfortable in one of the sturdy chairs and lit a cigarette made from Plowman's planet grass. It had been a good week. He had seen a lot of Molly, and he had become friends with Nurb Koldak, the warm-hearted bivalve.
"Here's one you're telling on Deneb 4," the bivalve said. "A Freb, whom we'll call A, is trying to sell a glank for 50,000 perfels.
"What's a Freb?" Joe asked.
A kind of..."
The bivalve undulated with effort.
A sort of idiot."
"What's a burfel?"
"A monetary unit, like a crumble or a ruble. Anyhow, someone says to the Freb, 'Do you really expect to get 50,000 perfels for your glank?'"
"What's a glank?" Joe asked. Again, the bivalve undulated. This time it turned bright pink with effort.
A pet, a valueless lower life form. Anyhow, the Freb says, 'I got my price.'"
"You got your price?"
the interrogator interrogates.
"Really?"
"Sure," the Freb says. "I traded it for 2 25,000 burfel pidnids.
"What's a pidnid?" The bivalve gave up. It slammed its shell shut and withdrew into privacy and silence. "We're tense," Joe said to himself. "Even Nurb Koldak. It's getting to us all." He rose to his feet then. Molly had entered the room. "Here," Joe said, getting a chair for her.
"Thank you,"
Molly murmured as she seated herself. She seemed pale, and when she lit a cigarette, her hand shook.
"You should have lighted that for me," she said to him, half-jokingly and half-accusingly. "I guess I'm the last to arrive."
She glanced around the chamber. "You were dressing?" Joe asked.
"Yes," she nodded. "I wanted to look right for what we're going to be doing."
Joe said, "How does one dress for polyencephalic fusion?"
"This."
She rose to show him her green suit.
"I've been saving this for a special occasion. This is a special occasion."
She reseated herself, crossed her long, trim legs, and smoked vigorously. Obviously, she was deep in thought. She hardly seemed aware of him. Glimmung entered the room. His form was new to them. Joe studied the prim, bag-shaped entity and asked himself why Glimmung had imitated this particular form of life. To what star system is this indigenous, he wondered.
My dear friends, Glimmung boomed. The voice had not changed. First, I want you to know that I am fully recovered physically, although psychologically a trauma remains, making my memory erratic. Second, I have had tests run on all of you without your knowledge and at no inconvenience to you, and I have the data which tell me that you, too, are physiologically in top form. Mr. Fernwright, I want to thank you especially for halting my premature efforts to raise the cathedral.
Joe nodded. After a pause, the bag-shaped object reopened its slit-like mouth and continued.
You all seem very quiet.
Getting to his feet, Joe confronted Glimmung. What are our chances of living through this?
Good, Glimmung said.
But not excellent, Joe said. Glimmung said, I will make a compact with you. If I feel my strength waning, if I feel I can't make it, I will return to the surface and disgorge you.
And then what? Molly asked.
And then, Glimmung said, I will go back down and try once more. I will try until I can do it.
Three morose eyes snapped open in the center of the bag-like shape.
Is that what you mean?
Yes,
the reddish jelly supported by a metal frame said.
You are really only concerned with that? Glimmung asked him. Your personal safety?
Joe said, that's right. He felt odd saying it. By this he had voided the dedicated atmosphere which Glimmung had brought with him. Instead of the joint effort, the individual lives had become paramount. And yet, he had had to do it. It was the consensus of the group, and in addition, it was his own feeling.
Nothing will happen to you, Glimmung said.
Assuming, Joe said, that you can get us up to the surface in time, and on dry land. Glimmung, with his three centrally located eyes, regarded him for a protracted interval.
I did it once, he said.
Examining his wristwatch, Joe said, Let's get started.